The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
2-2 pitch. Swing and a long drive. Deep left. Way back. Gone.
All right. Welcome to another session of the Dynasty Summit Series. This week, we have our first guest on. We'll have a series of guests over the next couple of weeks. But our first one is a legend in the industry. Someone that I think does incredible work over at RotoWire, has been doing it for quite a long time, has a great process. That, of course, is James Anderson. What's going on, James? How are you?
Hey, Jeff. Hey, Dylan. Great to be with you guys. I'm doing great. Always love talking dynasty and prospects with you guys. So thanks for the invite.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was going to say, of course, my co-host here, Dylan White, the master of the Robo Scout. I always get a different name every week, but I was thinking about this offline. I didn't say this to either of you, but when I was thinking about this show and like what we would talk about, and it was kind of funny because I honestly feel like you two are among people that I talk to a lot about baseball or chat with here and there. Two of the better multifaceted fantasy players. And what I mean by that is, you guys have been successful in a wide variety of formats. You're really good redraft players, of course. You know, I know James has been somebody that for years has always been, I think, one of the better redraft players that I've played with. And then excellent dynasty players as well. You know the player pool, you know prospects, you understand strategy. You do a lot of things really, really well. And there's very few people, I think, that do this as well as both. So I think for those tuning in, you have two great minds here, two actual great players. They walk it like they talk it, so to speak. So,
well, thank you for all those kind words. And yeah, I mean, I think Dylan's absolutely great. I hope he's not in any of my NFBC leagues this year, and yeah, leave it at that.
Yeah, exactly. I want to be in dynasty leagues with you guys because I know you know what you're doing. And I feel like the sustainability of like a dynasty league is very important to have good plugged in players that know what's going on. That's a huge component of those leagues actually lasting beyond year one, year two, where we often see them fold. So with that being said, I wanted to have a little bit of conversation about, you know, dynasty strategy, the things that are changing out there. I know that, James, you've been doing work at RotoWire for a really, really long time. You know, I date back to Razzball at a similar point in time. And things with Dynasty have evolved a lot. The type of games that people play, how deep the prospect rosters are versus what they were years ago. You know, and that was just even beyond like those pro boards leagues with like, you know, salary caps and all that sort of stuff that was really, really like niche within a niche. It's got more expanded. I think that like it's more regular now that you know someone who's in Dynasty Baseball League that may roster, you know, 300 plus prospects at any given time. So I wanted to throw this over to you, James, and certainly an open conversation. So Dylan, of course, jump in. What sort of things are you seeing out there now that are changing in terms of strategy, how people are doing things differently?
Yeah, you know, I think this has kind of been a common, you know, battle, I think, among dynasty sort of analysts and dynasty players in terms of like, should you be, you know, playing for kind of the long game? Should you be playing for the here and now? And I think I've noticed the like the big leagues, it's just become more and more and more of a young man's game. Certainly more than it was like 10 years ago. I think so many teams are trying to kind of copy the Rays with loading up on pre-arb big leaguers to keep salaries low. And, you know, you flip those guys when they start getting expensive, and you make sure that your farm system's always got a decent amount of talent in it. And so with so many young players, you know, ranking highly on redraft rankings, especially on the hitting side, I think that's an important distinction to make. I think it's just become more clear to me than ever before that, you know, if you're doing like a startup dynasty draft right now, I really think it's gotten to the point where you're maybe just kind of missing things if you're not trying to win the league, you know, at least kind of 20 picks into your startup draft. Because you like, I do obviously a lot of redraft leagues this time of year, and I look at those rosters and they're very young rosters. So why would I be playing dynasty different, right? Like, you know, I've got so many, like I just did a dynasty or a redraft league where I took like Noelvi Marte and Ezekiel Tovar and Tristan Casas, and that's for redraft. But, you know, those guys are great options in both redraft and dynasty. So I think you can draft a young-ish dynasty team that is ready to win that first year. And, you know, obviously it kind of goes without saying, if you're following prospects and you're kind of staying up on who's breaking out, if you're following Dylan's work, you don't necessarily have to just get the guys who are really good prospects when you're doing that first startup draft. You'll find the next guys. And you can really kind of fall behind if you go into like that startup draft with the plan of not even trying to contend that first year, because you're going to be in a league with really talented drafters, good analysts, you know, of young players who are going to be able to kind of have their cake and eat it too, and draft a team that's ready to win, but also a team that has the pieces to stay competitive for a while. So I was probably a little kind of too late to kind of fully jump to that side of the aisle of really kind of valuing the here and now. But I do think that that's just become a really viable way to go. I think even if the whole league is going that way, you know, if you deal with some injuries or you make some bad picks or whatever, you know, somebody's going to have to pivot into kind of a mini rebuild, or at least a few teams are. But there's no reason to kind of like wave that white flag right away from day one. And I just think the game is going to stay very young. Pitching is kind of a different animal, I think, than hitting. You look at like the best pitchers, the pitchers who get drafted the highest. Obviously Spencer Strider is the best, and he's young, but a lot of those guys are older. They're in their, you know, late 20s, early 30s. And we expect those guys to be good for, you know, another few years. So like you shouldn't be skewing young with pitchers, in my opinion, regardless of what your competitive window is. But you know, I think it's more of a young player's game at the big league level. So I do think you can draft a youngish dynasty league team that's ready to win right now.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think there's all these articles like, should you be going win now or win later? And you kind of have to make a decision by like round five in a startup. But now it's kind of, you can wait till, like you're saying, like round 20, because the redraft teams kind of map onto, like you're saying, the dynasty teams. They're very similar, so you don't really have to make that choice. I think because things are skewing so young as well, I don't know if you heard the 4-hour marathon pod that Rob DiPietro had.
I haven't listened to that one yet.
But basically they're talking about how everyone at fantasy baseball in redraft high stakes leagues are getting so much better. And so like the edges are smaller and smaller, and you have to find edges. And so now like Phil and Zimmerman are like going through the AAA stat cast, and they're trying to do prospect hunting because they know they're going to come up. And that might be the edge to be able to find the next guy to draft and hold that's, you know, going to come up in July and add some value. So I think they're onto something for the high stakes leagues. And so I just basically supporting what you're saying, that it's a younger game and you're going to see the AA prospects, the AAA prospects come in and make a meaningful impact in this season.
And I think some of the stuff in real life baseball has forced some of that, right? Like years ago, when it was a very viable strategy to go in and buy up the top 10 prospects that you could get to start a draft. And guys like built machines out of this, like legitimate, like title contending, winning, you know, great dynasty lineups. It feels like you can't do that any longer because you don't have the same restrictions with, well, there's incentives now with teams wanting to obviously promote prospects, especially guys who are on top 100 lists, which means the top guys, right? The guys that are on all three top 100 lists that have legitimate shots of being rookie of the year and have opportunities with their major league clubs are usually the guys that are in the top 25 of these prospect lists, whether it's Baseball America's, whether it's Baseball Prospectus, Keith Law, you know, MLB Pipeline, whoever. Those are usually the elite, like the elite guys, the guys that actually hit and turn out to be sevens and like legitimate superstars and top two, three round kind of fantasy guys for 10 years. They're ranked in that area. And those are the guys that are getting pushed up, I think, by a lot of like the prospect promotion incentive. And that's some of like the real life impact is had on, you know, the fantasy game, where years ago, you had even someone who was like a no doubt guy, like Chris Bryant, was, you know, held down to a certain date because of Super 2, because of, you know, how all that stuff worked. Now there's incentive to do the opposite, because if they get a first round pick, there's obviously more surplus value for a team for that. Or, you know, like they're more likely to do it. They're more likely to take that shot and call those young guys up. So I think that like the game itself with young players and how quickly a guy can move now has really skyrocketed up, and it has made the game younger because it's forcing out some of those fringy cheap roster guys that could get it done on bad teams. Now those bad teams have an incentive not to, you know, keep their prospects in the minors for an extra 2, 3, 4 months, sometimes a full year. I mean, I think we can look back on some of these guys and be like, Vlad Guerrero Jr. in like 2018 probably could have been in the major leagues in 2019. And if this incentive had existed, maybe he and Bo are up a year earlier even. So I think that's had some impact on it. And I think it's one of the reasons that it's such a, it, you know, it's such a potential edge if you do know the player pool. And I think a lot of it is like the player pool and the 40-man roster. You know, I don't think knowing low A 19-year-old guys who just came off the complex is going to necessarily have the same impact in a redraft setting. That's, you know, when you start to get into your really deep dynasties. But I do think like looking at AAA's stat cast and just getting a better understanding for the player pool is going to be more important in a redraft as well.
Yeah. And I think the, like what Dylan was saying about, you know, redraft players are getting better, I think dynasty players are also getting a lot better, and it's not necessarily the same types of thing, you know, like, you know, I don't think dynasty players are running the same type of algorithms and stuff that some of the redraft players are, but the dynasty format's been popular for long enough now. I think a lot of people have played it for 5, 10, 15 years. You learn a lot of lessons along the way, and I think one of those lessons that you know, some people could still learn is what you were talking about, Jeff, with that the talent really is those top guys. It's a real steep drop off with the prospects. Like to me, there's maybe 20 prospects that I would really kind of covet in trade right now in like a dynasty league. And after those top 20 or so, you know, maybe not the same 20 as you have or someone else has, but it's a real steep drop off to me in terms of like, yeah, sure, I'll trade that guy to help my team win now. I realize the bust rate on the 45th best prospect is quite a bit higher than some people might realize. And I'm not even banking on that player to turn into anything necessarily. Like it'd be great if they do, but I think dynasty players have gotten a lot smarter about what to do with those kind of mid-tier prospects. Like you don't want to hold on to all of them. You got to pick which ones you really want to hold on to. And if you can move, you know, a guy that's got some helium, but is 2.5 years away from the majors, you know, I think that's becoming a more kind of accepted, this is how you do it type of move in Dynasty. And, you know, the best way to learn in life and in fantasy, I think, is just through mistakes. And so if you've made, you know, some really bad trades over the years, you know, hopefully you're doing some looking back and being like, oh, yeah, I probably could have done it a little differently there. So I think everyone's getting better right now.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, they're used to, when I first started Dynasty, which was like 2017, maybe, like there are very few prospect outlets where I can get the information. And I don't know anything about it back then. And now there's everyone's got their blogs and their Patreons and they're doing work. They're doing their data-driven stuff. They're making their lists. They're posting them on Twitter. So everyone has way more access than they did before. And I think some of the stuff you're talking about, like philosophies, where it's like there's a lot of talk about use prospects as currency, or it's like the stock market and you want to buy low, sell high. And when I first started, like I had like Chance Cisco as my catcher and I was going to wait till he graduated. He was going to replace my other catcher. Like that's how I was thinking about it, because I don't know like how like the Dynasty game's being played. And now it's like you churn the bottom and make sure you have a spot and don't invest in pitchers and all. There's kind of like truisms that are very, very widespread and mainstream now.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, all that stuff is becoming true. And it's funny because I'm going to sort of set you up here, James, a little bit. You had mentioned something specific to catchers that I thought was interesting. And I kind of felt like it was in some ways like the Dynasty sort of market or whatever going full circle. But if you don't mind me putting you on the spot here, sort of refresh my memory of like, you know, what your take was on catchers and something that you were seeing actually, I think, out in the wild as well.
Yeah, you know, I think maybe 3-4 years ago, it became pretty clear to me that, yeah, I think I was like ranking maybe like 8 catching prospects in my top 100 or something, like just something crazy that I'd just never done before. And you know, that was, you know, you go back like 8-10 years for anyone who hasn't been playing that long. Like I remember like the first Dynasty league I played in, I would say it was like a 20 team league. And I would bet, you know, maybe 8 of the 20 teams had a catcher at that point that they were like, yeah, this is my guy. This is going to be my catcher this year. He's going to be my catcher next year. But now if you're in a 20 team league where everyone just starts one catcher, there might only be 3 or 4 teams in your league that don't think their catcher of the future is on their current roster. You know, maybe they've got like a mediocre big league catcher, but they've got Ethan Salas waiting in the wings or Samuel Basayo. You know, you just don't have that many teams in a league like that that are actively looking for an upgrade at that position. And of course there are, I think it's just really criminal almost to do a dynasty, like a startup Dynasty league these days, where you're only starting like 15 catchers total in the league, just given how deep the position's gotten. But those leagues exist. And then there's leagues, you know, there's 30 team leagues where everyone starts a catcher. There's 15 team leagues where everyone starts 2 catchers. I'm sure there are 20 team leagues where everyone starts 2 catchers. So obviously the format matters in terms of what the demand's going to be for catchers. But like I did my first startup Dynasty draft this off season with a friend, co-manager. And it was a 15 team, one catcher league. But I remember like looking at the draft board, like 25, 30 picks in, and there were multiple teams that had put like 3 of their higher picks into catchers in this like one catcher league. And it was an expensive league. It was like $150 like Fantrax league. And it's crazy to me. Like you're putting, you know, it's so fun to have an awesome, you know, young catching prospect, especially one that, and you can find those guys off waivers a lot of times. You know, Basayo was off waivers, obviously. And it's great to find those guys, and they last on waivers longer than they would if they were shortstop or an outfielder or whatever. But you just, you know, having 4 of the 25 best Dynasty catchers on your roster it's just not that useful. And it's there's always going to be pop-up catchers in the minors every year too. So if you go into the season with three catchers you don't want to drop and only one spot for you to start a catcher, you're not going to pick up any of the breakout catchers that come in off waivers. And you're not really going to be able to move the guys that you have, and you're not playing for what you would consider fair value. Like if you have a really good shortstop prospect or a really good outfield prospect, every team always needs more of that, right? But it's just like I see teams or people building their dynasty teams with like four catchers, three catchers in a one catcher league. It's just crazy to me. Like it's just, I hate it. I would never do it. But like there are different leagues where I'm sure that is actually something you can benefit from if people are out there really scraping the bottom of the barrel for their second catcher or whatever. But these guys are going to keep popping up. Teams love having a ton of catching depth. Teams love like the Orioles aren't going to trade Samuel Basayo. Like I really don't think they're gonna. He's too good. Like they don't need to trade Samuel Basayo to get the players they need. So like teams don't look at this as a problem. They're not like, oh crap, we have too many good catchers. Like the Dodgers would love to have just five awesome catchers in their system at all times. So I just think it's a position that people, you definitely want to get great production from the catcher position. I think that's an old misnomer that's been proven wrong a long time ago, that like just go cheap at catch or whatever. But having a good catcher on your bench or like two good catching prospects with a good catcher in your big league lineup, it's just a waste of resources.
Absolutely. And like you said, there's not a ton of leagues necessarily where, depending upon the depth, especially when you think about the types of leagues that a majority of people are playing in, they're not rostering multiple catchers probably like in the starting lineup. They're not playing in two catcher leagues necessarily. It's probably shallower than 15 teams even. So a lot of the readers, people watching out there sometimes probably play in leagues where they don't really have the same demand. But a lot of those players, like you said, are being drafted in droves, and it feels like every year there's, three catching prospects that sign for decent money that come stateside that rake, and then three more guys out of the draft. I mean, just take a look at last year's draft. We had Kyle Teal. Teal was up to AA, I think, has a legitimate shot of reaching the big leagues this year. And that's someone that was, entering his draft spring at this time last year. And here we are talking about him, potentially playing in the big leagues with the Red Sox next year. It's incredible.
And it's definitely like, I'm not trying to say like you don't want Kyle Teal or you don't want Basayo or Salas. It's more like, like an Edgar Caro or a Jefferson Caro or, that kind of caliber of catching prospect to me, I just don't have any time for it because I'm aiming higher than that. Like I don't want the 15th best catcher in a one catcher league. I want the best catcher, top five catcher. It's just more that depth where it's like, okay, what's the best case scenario with this guy? Like he's the 14th best catcher during his mid 20s. Like, great. Like that's really not that valuable.
Yeah, I mean, really what you're speaking to is what's the replacement value in your league, and then what's going to be the replacement value in 3 years if you have the Cueros, the two Cueros, and Andy Rodriguez and all these guys coming in. You're raising the replacement level, and so that kind of compresses the top. You're only, $5 better than the bottom catcher if you have such a great crop of catchers. So you kind of have to anticipate what the landscape's going to look like. I think when you're talking about having like the eight catchers in your top 100, it's like, oh, that's going to dilute their value now. And so like everyone else is kind of lower. And so like an Adley Rutschman or a Will Smith maybe aren't as valuable because there's this crop coming in and they're going to be right on their tails and kind of be, only $10 worse or whatever in if you do valuations. So definitely you have to, I guess my point is the takeaway is know your league and the settings. If you're a 15 team, one catcher league, the replacement catcher is like the 16th best. And so, number 15 is only worth a dollar. So anyone below that is quote unquote zero. And then also try to anticipate what it's going to look like in, 3 years who's going to be the 15th best catcher and kind of reevaluate and reassess from there.
And if you're in a 15 team, one catcher league, and you're doing a startup, if you want to take Adley, you want to take, William Contreras, Will Smith, whoever, that's fine. But if you're just going to take Sean Murphy, like, just be the last person to take a catcher, because there are 15 really good catchers this year.
That's Sean Murphy slander. Sean Murphy was excellent in the first half of the year, and then that injury just drove him into the ground, and he was terrible in the second half. I don't know what to make of him, because, like, if he's healthy like that for a full season, even if it was 75% of what it was in the first half and the second half, he's going to finish in the top five of that position. And he's in that lineup where, like, Eddie Rosario's counting stats, like, pushed him into, like, the top 150 last year, just about. And it's Eddie Rosario. I mean, come on, right? I don't know. Sorry. I like Sean Murphy.
Well, that's almost like what, like, that almost proves my point, like, he's probably the 10th catcher by ADP this year. And he's, he's a guy that Atlanta needs healthy for the postseason. He's wasn't really an Iron Man in the minors. He's a big guy. They have Travis d'Arnaud. Like, they're not going to run him out there as much as the Orioles are going to run Adley Rutschman out there. And, there's how much better is he than Sal Perez? How much better is he than Francisco Alvarez? How much better is he than Wilson Contreras? Like, there's a lot of good catchers out there right now.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Why do I use Indeed for our hiring at Baseball America? Because it takes so much of the busy work out of hiring and does it for me. I can find highly qualified candidates in one place, set up interviews, and communicate with them all on Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualification and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So you use Indeed. As you use it more, the better it gets. And listeners to this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
It's fair. It's a good point. Catching has certainly changed. Just depends where you can get Murphy. I don't know. I feel like he's cheap. And I'm not starting with any full redrafts this year. Startups, at least in a while. So talk to me a little bit about anything you guys have been doing in the off season. I've had 3 FYPDs going on. Have you done any startup dynasty drafts? You've just been doing redraft stuff, NFBC stuff. What have you guys been working on?
I did the one startup. I haven't done any FYPDs. I wrote a wire I get people asking about first year player draft stuff in like October and November. I'm just like, what kind of crazy ass league are you in where you guys are doing that before the J15 guys sign? But yeah, I mean, I think most of mine are, you know, maybe they start in like mid late February. Some of them start in March. It's kind of like this most years, but there is some kind of contentious sort of decisions near the top for FYPD. Like, you know, just a lot of people asking like, well, is it a mistake to take so I've got like a group of four guys after like Wyatt Langford and Yoshinobu Yamamoto, like Walker Jenkins, Paul Skeens, Dylan Cruz, Matt Shaw to me are kind of in a tier together, but like you know, you just got to do your best kind of within that tier. Nothing wrong with taking Cruz third, nothing wrong with taking Walker Jenkins third, nothing wrong with taking Skeens third. I don't think there's much kind of breaking into that top two, but I'm sure that they won't go as the top two in every FYPD. So it's just, you know, and, you know, where do you put like Colt Emerson? You know, where do you put the top J15 guys? It's such a loaded pool. I'm kind of anxious to have an FYPD get going here.
I'm going to say this. So like I said, I'm in the midst of three right now, and they're kind of my big three. One of them is the RAS 30, as James is familiar with. Is my league mates have been going to James for inside strategy, etc., for years. So I have to work hard to combat that. I traded for a ton of second rounders and trades this year, as like instead of going after first rounders, but earlier second rounders, any second rounder that I could get. And I got a few of them. I actually had the first pick in the second round. And they were like throw-ins in larger deals. And it was really just me going back and being like, hey, would you throw in a second? Because we can only trade first, second, and thirds in that league. And people don't value the seconds like they value the first. I knew how deep this draft was. And the fact that there are also players who get released back into the pool who were rostered prospects during the season. And like those second round picks like are pretty valuable. And just in terms of what you can get back for them in trade value, turn them into something else, or type of players that that you're able to, you know, pick up there. So like I think that's another thing. This year is like, if your league is a little bit deeper and you go several rounds in the FYPD, trade for second round picks if you can, because there's going to be a lot of really good players that drop into the second round because it's a loaded hitting class in particular. A lot of college hitting, which are like fast moving guys who are going to move up the board, probably get drafted a little bit earlier, which means a lot of like those talented prep guys are kind of sliding down the board. Nate Handy here, a friend of all of ours, is in that RAS 30 league, and he called out me taking Colin Hulk at 55. I mean, that's a first round pick. That's a, you know, a prep shortstop where debate how high the upside is, but that's typically where the big hits come from, are international guys and high school players from the United States. It's not necessarily college guys. College guys typically are a little bit safer, etc. But it's just, you're going to try to hit like some big homers. It's going to be those international guys, and it's going to be those prep picks.
And to your point, Jeff, like I just checked, I've got 20 FYPD guys, not counting. I don't rank like Yamamoto on my prospect rankings, but like I've got 20 traditional prospects in my top 100 from this first year player draft class. And that's a high number. You know, I know, you know, that like usually I'm putting like 9 or 10 guys in the top 100. And it's partly because I think it is there was kind of a talent drain last year with the amount of guys that got to the big leagues. But it's just the way that I rank prospects, like I'm more interested in seeing what, you know, some of those prep shortstops become, knowing that they might not become anything, than I am to sort of see what some like 22-year-old guy who I know is never going to be a top 25 prospect, you know, like it's just, if you're looking for upside, first year player draft is kind of where you got to go for it.
Well, I'll even say, I think if you're looking for floor, your best bet a lot of the time is to go after like top two round high school guys, the guys who get big bonuses that have talent. And like you read the scouting report, you know that, you know, there was performance, you know, on the showcase circuit, et cetera. And that's easy information to find nowadays too. Years ago, it wasn't. You can use Baseball America. There's available reports on a million different guys from a million different websites, and the draft as well, as that area has expanded. And I, you know, I feel like when you're making these picks, you want guys that you're going to want to hold a spot in your roster and keep, depending upon what the format is. And more often than not, regardless of really what format I'm going after, the guys that I regret drafting are typically like the sure thing bets of like, oh yeah, this guy's going to move quick, or it's somebody that's going to be in the rotation next year. And then I look back in a year later and I'm like, why didn't I take, you know, whoever it was that was a talented international guy or a high school player where there was like some idea that he could hit and there was some offensive game. If it's just like a glove first guy and you can read that in the scouting report and pick that up, obviously that's a different story. But like I read a lot of the reports in this international class and it feels like there's five or six really interesting outfielders that are kind of toolsy and like have loud, you know, impact potentially in the barrel. And then, you know, I talked to Ben and he kind of, where we have them in our list is where Ben would place them in the list. And Ben obviously knows the amateur stuff domestically really well too. So it's good to get a balance there. But this is a really talented class overall. So there's just a ton to get there. And I think, you know, from year to year, we sometimes push up guys like Austin Martin and some of these other college players. And we've already seen 2 years of development, 3 years of development that we haven't necessarily seen with the high school guys. And teams are pretty good at this, you know. The guys you're seeing going in the first round.
They're okay at it. Really good at this. I mean, they're okay at it. There's still tons of whiffs. But you know, it's just so hard to get right. Mm-hmm. The one thing I would say about the international guys, if you're taking them in a first year player draft, it better be someone that you plan on holding for 3 months. Because you're just wasting a pick if you take a J15 guy and then you drop him around Memorial Day for some pop-up guy. At least take one of the guys that you know is going to be assigned to a full season league so that you can evaluate them before dropping them. Like that, like it's kind of like whatever, you know, three players, five players from the international class that you really believe in. After those guys, I'd rather just see who kind of pops up in the DSL, because I don't want to stash like the 10th best J15 guy for 3 months, knowing that he's like 5 years away from the majors. So that's just something to keep in mind if you're going after that.
But are those guys 5 years away from the majors now? Seriously though, like we look at Julio Rodriguez, we look at Wander Franco, we looked at, you know, Juan Soto, Vlad Guerrero Jr., the guys that are getting $4 or $5 million.
Leo DeVries.
Those are getting majors in 3 years now, you know.
Yeah, you name it. Yeah, you name like the best leagues. Guys to sign though, like the fifth best guys in those classes. It's 5 years.
I agree, but I think like those top like 5 to 10 players in the class in a year, those guys can blow up huge. I mean, Ethan Salas. We look at Sebastian Walcott. These guys become first year that they're eligible, more or less, end up getting pushed stateside, end up in top 100 lists, and immediately like you have significant return investment. And most of the time you're not taking those guys in the first round. You're taking a lot of them. I mean, outside of maybe Perdomo and definitely DeVries, you're taking those guys outside the top 40 picks in a lot of FYPDs. And if you're in deeper leagues, like that's where you're able to turn those guys into like legitimate major league pieces that help you compete. You know, at least that's been my experience.
Yeah. No, especially if you're willing to sell those guys, you know, before they get to like double A, but you're probably going to want to just ride it out, especially if it's like the top guy in the class.
I honestly will sell pretty much any prospect. There's very few guys that like I won't trade. Especially if I'm in a, you know, in a money league that's competitive, and I feel as if this is also like my job, where like I know prospects well enough that I know when someone is like to move on pretty quickly, and who I should move off of, you know. And I feel like there's just, they're making more of them every year, you know. And like, there's no guarantees those guys are obviously going to be stars, but every year in your dynasty leagues that you can trade 10 to 12 prospects and replace those guys within 12 months and enter the off season looking exactly the same and just unload those guys and reload. And a lot of the times you're trading back for players you might've traded away 3-4 years ago, but I don't care. Like, you want to own those players at their peak value, regardless of, you know, how attached you are to them or how much you may like the player, you know. I feel like, at least for me over the last couple of years, like, I've gotten to the point that I'm fine trading away multiple prospects, knowing that 3 years down the road, I might go, oh, I can't believe I traded all that for this guy. But if it means that I get right now production for 2 years, that's valuable. And I think like it's a formula that you can repeat, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the most willing to trade prospects, I think, because I trust my ability to backfill. So I'm always trading prospects, even the good ones. But I think what we're seeing, like with the DSL guys, to speak to both your points, is like when Soto and Acuna came up, they're the hot name. Oh, who's the next DSL guy? And so we saw like Luis Rodriguez, Eric Pena. What was that guy on the Brewers? I can't remember his name.
Edgar Perez.
Thank you. Yeah. all being taken early first round, and then they haven't really panned out, and so now the kind of the market has soured on the DSL guys. And like, so maybe now's the time that, you know, like if you tried to sell the 5th through 10th DSL, or try to trade the 5th through 10th DSL guy from a couple years ago, you're not really going to get any bites. You're not going to get anything, because I think people are very skeptical that like this is just going to be another whatever, name the names. And so they're, you can't really get value for them, but so like maybe it's an opportunity
that's kind of what I've been experiencing. I think I kind of mentioned this like earlier, Dylan, but like, have you noticed that where in your leagues where it's like just the other teams have just gotten so much smarter about, no, I'm not taking your 3 prospects ranked in the like 60 to 120 range for this like very productive big leaguer. Like, it just seems like obviously you jump on those trades if you can pull it off. It just seems like everyone's gotten pretty smart to the point where it's a lot tougher to pull off those types of like obvious prospect for big leaguer trades.
I think definitely people are getting smarter. I think people are also, they're not just like going for the prospect name. I think maybe this is just my perception, but I feel there's a lot of volatility and movement in prospect lists now. So someone who's not even on the top 400 suddenly jumps to like 120. And so people are skeptical, like anyone can jump on this list and anyone can have value. So like, do I want to trade for I'm just pulling a name out of this, not because I don't think this person's any good or anything, but like Justin Foscue or like some of these kind of fringe names that will be big leaguers, but how productive are they? Are they going to be stars? Probably not. Like, why would I trade for Justin Foscue when someone else can just pop up out of nowhere and be like a Josue DePaula or whatever, and suddenly have a lot of value and a lot of helium? So I'm finding people are much smarter, much more plugged into the prospect world. And so you can't really just like hear 4 prospects for George Springer like you used to be able to do in dynasty leagues. Like, I remember I traded Sal Perez in that 2017 league for like Khalil Lee and Jorge Soler, because I'm like, oh, Sal Perez is old and Khalil Lee is going to steal so many bases. Like, those types of deals don't really happen anymore at all.
No.
Depends what kind of league you're in, man. Depends what kind of league you're in. I feel like you're in a certain level of league right now, and you play with certain buy-ins, so you're not necessarily seeing everything.
That's a really good point, Jeff. Like, there are just wide-ranging leagues, like, and like formats, mm-hmm. you know, how many prospects are rostered. like the how many prospects are rostered part is huge in terms of like how valuable is a prospect in your specific league. Like if 500 prospects are rostered, it's a lot harder to backfill. But if 150 prospects are rostered, it's super easy to backfill. Exactly. So like it really matters what format you're playing in, and people listening or watching know their league's tendencies. And, you know, if you can keep pulling off those types of trades, you do it. If you're new to Dynasty, if you're kind of new to like trading big league for prospects, like I would just say, like, don't do it unless it's just such a clear win to you that like you don't feel like you have a choice. But like you shouldn't be considering these prospect for big leaguer trades if you're looking at it as kind of like a coin flip. Like it needs to just be like, yeah, I don't really have any choice here. I have to take this deal.
I think like major leaguers over 30, 31, 32, I can get down with some of those trades. I'm fine with that. So when you're trading like 27, 28 year olds to get a 21 year old, I think you're losing a lot in that sort of swap. You know, I think there can still be like good deals made in the prospect for major leaguer world, like that work for both teams. You know, I don't think it's dead necessarily. There was actually a good question here I wanted to throw up that we got in the chat from Andrew Mason. It says, do you guys have any tips or negotiation strategies when trying to trade prospects or for prospects? Can be tricky in our league and having different teams, having different valuations or trade tactics. I think that's accurate. Dylan or James, do you guys which one wants to tackle this one first?
You want to go?
Well, I feel a lot better about trading prospects when I have a very good idea what that player is. I don't love trading. Like, I wouldn't want to trade, like Leo DeVries, for instance. Like, if I draft him in, like, an FYPD, I'm not trading him in June. I want to see what he does, and I want to see, like, if his stock can climb a little bit. Justin Foscue, like Dylan mentioned, like, I think we all know what Justin Foscue is. So it's so much easier to kind of be like, this is what he is. This is what he could turn into if he gets the opportunity. It's so much easier to kind of be like, all right, I can move this guy. I know what I'm missing out on, or I know this is what it could look like if he really pans out. I don't know. That's just one way I kind of look at it, but I'd be interested to see what Dylan says.
I find it hard for people to trade prospects with me, either if I offer them or I'm trying to ask for one. Like, I don't think I could just say, hey, what do you want for Miguel Blaise or something like that? Because they're immediately skeptical. Like, what does he know? And they're not going to make that trade. So one thing I do, and this may not work in all cases, is I try to find out, and I actually keep a little note beside the team names of like which outlets they seem to be following. Like if you have your FYPD list come out, James, and then I see that people are kind of tracking to it in the draft, I'm like, oh, it looks like they're using James's list. And so I'll always remember that and have that written down, that James's list. So I will like look at your list and see who's higher on a list and then make that trade, because I know that other owner will look at the teams and say, oh yeah, well, this is a good deal because he's ranked higher. You need to be meticulous like I am and have a list of every team and who you think they're following. And it's not necessarily going to work anyway, but yeah, it is difficult. I think you need to also know the tendencies of your league. Are the other opponents you're playing with, do they like prospects? Do they not like prospects? Obviously, you have to kind of tailor the trade offers and negotiations around that. I think another thing, this is the thing that Brian Slack, my co-manager from the main event team, he used to use this technique. He calls it up and down the ladder, which is, if he's going for it, he's not just trading his prospects for win now players, because that will restrict his trading partners to only those who have like veteran players who will be willing to trade for prospects. He will trade his productive major league players for prospects if he feels that he's getting better value, because that now opens up more trading partners, because now he has a good prospect that he can now trade. And so he just, as long as he's gaining value in the trade, he will take a prospect, even if he's going forward, or take a veteran who has value, even if he's in a rebuild, because he wants to keep his options open. So maybe Andrew, that might be an option. Like, don't just look for the prospects you want. Try to think of like subsequent like fallout and subsequent deals you can do after making an initial trade.
That's way too much trading for me personally.
yeah.
Trading's honestly my least favorite part of Dynasty Leagues. I know for a lot of people it's their favorite part, but it's probably the thing I'm worst at in Dynasty Leagues is trading, because I just don't put much time into it at all. Mm-hmm. And I don't really have the time to put into it. So, you know, for the most, and I'm too confident in my own evaluations. So, like, most of my Dynasty League team, like, everyone's going to make good trades and stuff. Most of my Dynasty League teams would be better if I just didn't trade anyone.
I've kind of felt that way for a long time. I used to call it the Berlin Wall strategy, where I just had like all of my players just like completely walled in and not traded. And I would make like a trade like here and there. I used it in a few leagues, and honestly, it worked, because I felt like I knew the player pool. I knew the types of players that I liked. And I also had some continuity with my roster, meaning like I knew what the strengths were of my team because I had sort of meticulously followed it for 6 months the year prior, and then thought about it for another 3 months, and then built it up for another month and a half. So like, you know what your deficiencies are, I feel like. And like, you also kind of know what players are super frustrating that you want to move on from. Like, there's nothing that will put you off of a player after rostering them for a year and like feeling like they're just, I remember like, it's one of the reasons I had Justin Upton on a ton of teams early on, like when he first came up, and he would do this thing where he'd be awful in the first half and then great in the second half. And he'd have like, or like vice versa. You'd have like one half where he was like the worst hitter in baseball, and like another half where he was the best hitter in baseball. And even though the numbers at the end of the year like worked, it was like I was so sick of dealing with it that I just traded away just everywhere I possibly could and got, you know, return on value. So I do honestly think it's a viable strategy to not trade. I do think there are certain formats where you're kind of forced to trade. Like my home league, longtime league, it is a keep eight with some options, meaning like we have some prospects. If they're in your minor league system, we roster like 5 to 7 on each team. And those guys get, you know, promoted up. You can keep them free for 2 years, but it's mostly a keep eight, and it's head to head points, which is chaos to begin with. And that format is chaos to begin with. And then you know, you factor in the keep eight. Training is like essential. Like, I wish I traded more in that league, to be honest with you, but there are certain formats where you really should be like putting your foot in the gas or taking as many assets for next year as you possibly can, and, you know, hoarding like a squirrel in the winter or something. I think depending upon the format and how the league works, there's always different strategies that you should even employ from year to year based on how things are working. No? I don't, have you guys played in any like head-to-head points dynasty formats at all? Because I'm in a few.
I'm in three head-to-head points keeper leagues that I joined in college, which is like 15 years ago, basically. Those are like, they're not, I keeper leagues and dynasty leagues to me are two different things. You know, like keeper league, you're keeping, you know, 6 to 10 big leaguers, maybe a couple prospects per team. Dynasty league, you're keeping, you know, 20 plus players. I'm not in any head-to-head points leagues where I would consider it a dynasty league, but I am in some keeper ones.
I'm not in any points or head-to-head. I was a long time ago, and I didn't really like it at all. I like Roto and how, like, the strategy of like looking at categories and how you can catch up and all that, whereas kind of points from my experience was just like, it is what it is and you can't really do anything about it.
I think it depends on the group. If you have like a close group of friends and it's a group that you like to talk smack against, I think like I can understand why the head-to-head format, particularly points, is good. I like the idea of points because it encompasses a lot more of the player's value in terms of like how many points they capture in a given year versus just like straight ahead 5x5 roto, you know? Like I personally hate batting average leagues. I don't want to play in a batting average league like ever, you know, even the leagues that I'm in that have batting average, I wish they would switch to OBP because it's just such a goofy stat, you know? And I honestly feel like from year to year, the value just fluctuates, that if you just tracked the counting stats, you added up the runs, RBIs, home runs, and stolen bases, that that would track almost equally along a straight line with fantasy value. And you wouldn't even have to factor in batting average all that much, because if they're doing all those things, the batting average is probably pretty good. You know, it's just there's no extra component of it to me that adds any intrigue at all. But I'm very sick of the standard 5x5, that I'd rather play OBP or some sort of like different type of scoring. I had one last year. I think it's a 6x6, and it had some sort of like run value that you could calculate out and figure it out. But it was like a really interesting wrinkle. So I don't know. I feel like expanding and trying different types of scoring, different types of formats is interesting and keeps it, you know, somewhat new. But I also think points is becoming a bigger and bigger part of fantasy baseball in general and a larger percentage of the leagues that are out there.
Well, I'm hoping to grow the standard 5x5 roto game. So I disagree with your take.
You like batting average?
I love 5x5 roto. Like,
oh my God.
Saves and wins are flawed stats too, man. Like, it's just, that's the game.
But saves and wins to me doesn't just erase an entire skill set that's super important nowadays, that teams value more than they value batting average. And it's also a much more true statistic. Like, from year to year, your OBP is much more true of your talent, especially when you factor in walks, versus just like guys who hit singles. Like, I don't know. I because you can even go after batting average stuff, like guys, and you can think you have a high batting average floor and it fluctuates 30, 40 points just based on luck and weird stuff. I don't like batting average, but regardless.
I mean, it depends what, like, if you're trying to recreate, if you're trying to make it as like realistic in terms of what's valuable as possible, of course it's a flawed format, but I'm not trying to do that. Like, I don't care about that.
I just don't, like, I don't think about players in terms of batting average. Like, I when I break down a player, I think about archetypes. Like, this is what I think about for, like, my job. It's my life. It's my obsession. I don't think about, like, oh, is he going to hit 250 or 290? I just think it's a bad question. Because it's like, I don't know, what's his batting average on balls in play going to be? You know, I can tell you, like, okay, like, it's probably going to be, I can tell you that number with more assurance, like, with more certainty than I can tell you what his batting average is going to be, because it's just, those numbers fluctuate wildly from year to year, unless you're, you know, Louis Arraez. It's like there's like five guys that actually hit for batting average now. And now we're chasing Billy Hamilton single category type guys. I don't know.
I think
a knock on
people him. Aren't chasing those guys though.
I just would much rather play OBP. I just think it's a better format. Kyle Schwarber's much better. Come on. Who doesn't want a format where Schwarber's better?
I think if I was playing in one league, I would want something that kind of emulates real baseball, like kind of like these Otnia leagues or whatever, where there's like salaries and you have to be like really into it. If I have like 10 leagues and then I have like the Highlander or like Mackey League that Derek and Riper has, like where it's just complicated contracts and it's like you can't pick up guys who are injured and Fab's on Thursday instead of Sunday. Like everything is kind of confusing. I don't like it because it just throws off my routine. So anything that kind of deviates from like the standard 5x5 or OBP instead of BA or, you know, saves and holds instead of saves, like anything more that, like if it's 9x9 or something, I won't like it. and I'll probably learn to like it if I play it in many years. I just don't have the intuitive grasp of these like arcane rule changes. So I just like the standard 5x5 as well, just because I know it. I'm just, it's comfortable, and it's like there's a common language amongst, you know, even people on Twitter and all that. And you can find lists and you can find, you know, rankings like very easily. And there's a lot of detail about it. So it's like out of laziness, I kind of prefer it. But I mean, obviously, if you're trying to emulate the real game, you're going to have like, you know, war and all that stuff.
I'm dealing with two purists. You're spot on, Christopher. Thanks for the comments. I 100% agree there. You guys are purists. I play in too many batting average leagues. I just feel like it's, I don't know. I don't like the stat, and it's in OBP to begin with. So
I love that Chris said I don't want a format where Schwarber is better. Yeah,
that was my favorite comment too, but I didn't want to pin that one on you. you don't appreciate the big beefy boys. It's fine. Yeah, I don't know. I think that, you know, I play in a variety of different formats. I like trying all the different ones, and you know, certainly I do like the holistic part of points, and especially with the deductions, whether it's for strikeouts, because it does balance like contact skills in a real way. And I think it's a much more interesting format, and different players can equal different values in very different ways. And I think that's very similar to real baseball, where like you look at a player like CJ Abrams, and it was funny because this was a conversation Dylan and I had this offseason, but like CJ Abrams is a much better fantasy hitter, like significantly so, than a real life hitter. I mean, he was a below average, what do you have, 87 WRC plus, a number somewhere around there. But fantasy wise, I mean, this guy is a 2050 threat, right? Like there's obviously a ton of value there for a guy like Abrams in a standard 5x5 format. That he doesn't necessarily have in like a real life setting, which I think is when we make lists, especially for Baseball America's, we do have a lot of more baseball purists. There's a bit of a disconnect between how that value is assessed in real life versus like how it's assessed with fantasy.
Well, I think when you're ranking prospects, like OBP is more important to ranking the prospect than mm-hmm. the batting averages. Because you have to get to the big leagues, you have to get into a role. And obviously the big league team's not going to look at your batting average, they're going to look at your OBP. So there might not be that big of a disconnect. Like, I mean, I think the, you know, catchers, I think, are usually ranked much higher on real life lists than fantasy lists.
Yes.
Pitchers, injured pitchers, like, That's where kind of the disconnect is to me.
Yeah, and defense, obviously, as well. Someone who's really good at defense, although it indirectly is important for fantasy because, I mean, playing time, there, you know, you find those guys, the defensive wizards on real life lists, obviously.
Yeah, and I had said this, I think, in maybe our prospect list, this like a preamble that we released this week, the fantasy top 100 prospects, but I sort of feel like with fantasy, I don't really care if he's a 50 defender or a 70 defender at shortstop. I just kind of want to know that he's going to get consistent playing time defensively, that like when he does slump, he's going to get an opportunity to break out of those slumps because he's a good defender, because the team's not going to want to take him out of the lineup, out of the field, etc. So that to me is really my only concern. But after a certain point, like I don't care if he's a 60 or a 70 when I'm ranking out a prospect for fantasy. When I'm creating a top 30 list for Baseball America, when we're doing the top 100 list, the fact that Carson Williams is a 70 defender is very important to me. And it's the reason he may rank above somebody else who might rank above him in a fantasy list, though I do like Carson Williams. But he's bad for standard 5x5. So he's off Dylan and James's draft list.
But I mean, speaking to that as well, like a 50 versus 70 defender at short, you know that the 70 defender, as he ages, can get moved to second or third probably, and you'll have a longer career, so there's more longevity. So it's like you have to consider all these different moving variables.
Yeah, I mean, like Joey Ortiz, if Joey Ortiz is a 50 defender, to me, he's like a utility player. But he's not. So like that's a case where it does matter, like 50 versus 60, 70.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like Cole Peterson, it's the bat. I mean, like the thing with Joey Ortiz is like, if Ortiz shows the impact he showed in the minor leagues at the major league level, and he proves that it's not a fluke. I think a lot of the way that he's reported and talked about isn't necessarily true to what the underlying data is. Like, Dylan has seen the numbers on Joey Ortiz. His EV numbers are really good. Like, it's not like he's even like slightly above average. Like, some of those EV numbers are well above average. And if you see the guy, he's strong. You know, he remade his body, he added a ton of, you know, muscle on a few years ago. Has always been a great defender, going back to, you know, when he was at New Mexico State. I just think, like, if he hits, he could be a 55 defender. That's fine. Like, it really comes down to whether he hits or not, you know. Will he get playing time? Sure. But then you're sort of talking about, like, the back end of middle infielders in a dynasty league, right? I mean, it's not – I mean, I'm not beating down any doors to own, like, or roster, like, Bryce Turang or someone like that, you know. I don't know. I mean, it depends. I mean, it certainly gets you opportunities, but J.P. Crawford kind of like, until he started to hit, like, what was his value like? No? He does get you opportunities in the major league level, that's for sure.
All right. I have a question
for
James. I was just wondering how he deals with being such a market mover with prospects in his leagues. Like, just not like whether there are like ethical quandaries you have if someone makes you an offer and you know that you're going to drop that prospect later in your release next week or whatever, but I just, knowing like the responsibility or that you have or how much you move markets, just how do you grapple with that in your leagues or anything like that?
I mean, it's a weird question. I just care way more about my prospect rankings than my dynasty teams. So I'd rather be right about my prospect rankings and like miss out on some players or something than the other way around. Like, you know, I've gotten this question before, and I don't like, you know, I think there are probably some leagues out there where, like, I hear about these leagues where it's like, yeah, half my league is using your rankings and stuff. And a lot of the leagues I'm in are kind of industry-ish leagues. So it's not like I'm playing in a bunch of home leagues where half the league's using my rankings. So it's more something I kind of like hear about than something I experience. But it is kind of weird, but obviously would just much rather put the time in on the rankings than on my dynasty teams in the off season.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I mean, I write my weekly RoboScout articles, and like, I'm not holding names back because I want to pick them up that day or whatever. I'm putting out who I think is making waves and who's interesting for that. But it's just like Rob DiPietro, for example, is always like, it's so funny. Every week you're writing these names and you're into my leagues and I'm reading your articles. Like, it's so strange.
It's worse in redraft because like that's there's a lot more money on the line, and sure. And it's kind of a, you know, like if all the guys I want like get taken in front of me, like that's really gonna negatively affect my season. Doesn't mean I hold anything back, but that is like much more of where I would notice it and be annoyed by it than in dynasty.
I think we all like the chase as well. And I'll just say that you think dynasty owners think you're colluding. Wait until major league teams get first round draft picks based off of things you put into actual prospect rankings. That's an interesting feeling. Getting yelled at by Tigers fans about Parker Meadows not being in the top 100. And I'm like, I neither did the Tigers list nor have the power to just push him onto the top 100. So sorry, I did a disservice. I actually read one the other day. You guys will appreciate this, where it was a response to a Keith Law tweet about his top 100 prospects. And I do kind of enjoy reading some of the comments on Keith because I can relate, as it's my job. And I just, you know, there's always some interesting interactions there. So there was one, and it was about Braves prospects, and it was something to the regard of the Braves don't talk to prospect writers or sites, which is absolutely not true, I can tell you that. And that's the reason that Braves prospects are underrated. And I was like, this is like, but it's like those conspiracies go out there in people's minds when you have any sort of power over rankings. It's kind of
that made me think of something else though. Like please don't like tweet at me or tweet at Jeff or someone and be like, or sometimes people will like jump into like a conversation on Twitter and they'll say like, this guy's rankings are way better than this guy's. And like, they'll tag the person they're saying rankings suck. Ugh. And it's just like, you know, now you're putting someone like, just stop tagging people who you think the stuff they're working for a living isn't very good. Like, at least just mention them without tagging them. Like, that's just an awkward situation. But
yeah. There's a lot of, but it's Twitter. So
yeah.
I don't know if we're going to stop that, but
no.
I just don't respond anymore. And like, no. You kind of automatically get muted. I don't block anybody, but I will mute you with the quickness so I don't have to see your tweets.
Yeah.
And it's great when I show up into a tweet and I'm reading the responses or something and it's like 17 people that I muted. But, you know, there you go. It's kind of how it goes in those Twitter streets. But we're a little bit over an hour now. I know I told James you would only be an hour. Anything you want to talk about before we wrap up here? Any work that you're putting out, stuff you're working on now that you're excited about? That you want to plug?
Yeah, for sure. You know, obviously got the top 100 prospect rankings. Those are very fresh, updated less than a month ago. Dynasty rankings updated about 2 weeks ago. First year player draft rankings updated less than a month ago. I just released yesterday my volume 2 of my rookie hitter rankings, which are just for redraft leagues. So I'm basically ranking and tiering hitters and including my player shares and recent ADP of my sort of preference order of rookie hitters. I'll have the rookie pitcher version of that the following week. And then a labor of love. I don't know how many people care about it, but one of my favorite things to do, I started last off season is I'll have like a big relief pitcher rankings, relief pitching prospect article where I try to go by, you know, all 30 teams and kind of look at which pitchers in each org could be in the closer mix within the next like 5 years or so. Probably a fruitless task, but, you know, I love doing that type of stuff. I love, like, you know, if you can end up with like Edwin Diaz before he becomes Edwin Diaz or Emmanuel Clase before he becomes Emmanuel Clase, that's huge. And it's really hard to do, but I really like kind of going team by team and trying to see like, and then, you know, obviously it's not just guys who are currently relief pitching prospects, but which starters are going to end up in the bullpen, that type of thing. So that'll be up in a couple weeks. Love talking with you guys, and you'll both hopefully be back on my podcast not too distant future.
Absolutely. You ask, I'll be there. Yes, I like that article quite a bit, and did some fun names in there last year. You know, there was some Griff McGarry slander, which
or Griff McGarry truth telling.
I don't know. We'll see. Griff was fine this year. Griff was fine this year. Had a little trouble in AAA with the wacky zone, but Griff's going to be fine. Griff's going to be fine. It's probably true. But the other thing is the best stuff when it comes to prospects is all the relievers. That's the guys that have the best stuff. It's all the you know, rubber arm Chads that end up being starters in the major leagues that are boring, that, you know, the stuff plus guys, those are all the guys that are going to be the relievers. But either way, yeah, that was a great article last year. I actually really, really enjoyed that. And I'm glad that you're going to be doing it again, because you went pretty deep. I think there were 40, 50-ish names. You kind of group guys together and talk about it a little bit.
I went really deep. Wouldn't be able to do it without my Baseball America sub, that's for sure. I'm going to mix up the format a little bit this year, like kind of do it more. Because last year I tried to do it like, which starters are going to end up in the bullpen, which current relievers do I like most. But I think it's going to be better to go like team by team and sort of look at like who actually has the best chance within each org to end up in that role. But, you know, even if you just go like 20% or 10% on reliever specs, you're doing pretty well.
It's fun. It's a fun area to look at. But James, I want to thank you for hopping on with me, for Dylan, for Jeff, for all of you that tuned in for over an hour. Much appreciated. We'll be back next week with another show. Thanks.